that's right. We're right here, Sharp Facets Gallery, this afternoon. And boy, do I have a treat for you. What was it, 2 weeks ago, maybe going on 3 weeks, July 27th, we went up there to Spartanburg to the memory service that honoring our Korean War veterans. It was the 60th anniversary of the armistice for the Korean War, which was July 27th, 1953. Senator Tim Scott was there, and a packed house of veterans were right there at the Readiness Center up there at Spartanburg. And I had the pleasure of sitting right behind me was Carrie and Ira King. So, Carrie, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine.
Doing fine. Mm-hmm. And Ira, how are you doing today?
I'm fine, yeah.
Yeah, you are a Korean War veteran, and we've been I've been listening to some fabulous stories here. One of the ones that we are going to talk about, I think everybody remembers the 1,000 Men and a Baby, and you were actually on that ship that brought that baby back, weren't you?
Yes, I was over the electrical division of that ship.
That's right. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about Ira and his life and everything, and then we're going to talk some about what this has all meant. So, Ira, now, where are you from originally?
I'm originally from the eastern part of Kentucky.
Ooh, that's a rough place, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Very, very rough.
Very rough. And your grandfather actually raised you, didn't he?
Yes.
Yes, and because your dad was
killed when I was 2 months old.
Wow. So you never really got to know your dad?
No, he was killed in an oil field accident. Cable broke.
Yeah, and what was your granddad called?
Called him Major King.
Major King.
But he wasn't a military man.
You know, we were talking about how different parts of the country are, and one of the things that you, of course, were telling me how, you know, everybody carries a gun up there.
Oh yes.
And you're not very welcome unless they know who you are, right?
That's exactly right.
Carrie, how was it the very first time you went there?
Very interesting.
Now, you're from New Mexico originally.
Yes.
Yes, so you'd never seen the likes of what Eastern Kentucky is like.
No, I did not.
You were telling me about how you went there one time and there was a looming battle. And, Carrie, you were saying that you wanted to find the hotel, right?
Yeah, I did.
Except there wasn't a hotel, was there?
No.
and you didn't go back. You were gone for a long time, and then you went back 10 years. And you were trying to find your oil field stake?
Yeah, find the Parpatish lines. And they wouldn't even have anything to do with us until my cousin went over and cussed them out and told them who we were. Then, by that afternoon, we had half a city hall out running around the country trying to find the stakes. So, if they don't know you, you're dead.
Well, let's put it this way. If you ain't family, you ain't in.
You ain't in.
Would that be right, Carrie?
That was it.
Well, when you graduated from high school, that was what year?
1950.
And you, what happened? What did you want to be when you grew up?
I wanted to be a lawyer, but that all fell through when I didn't have the money to go.
Yeah. I think, what'd you tell me, your brother got all the money to go?
Yeah. I was not the favorite son, so my brother got all the money, and so I decided to just go ahead and go in service. I think it was about 3 days after I got out of school. I went ahead and joined the Navy and went to Great Lakes. And I finished basic training and went straight into combat from basic training.
Now, let me just ask you something. A young man from Kentucky joining the Navy, why did you end up in the Navy?
Well, I don't know. I just kind of liked the Navy. Didn't want to walk a lot, so I didn't want the Army. But I just decided I'd try the Navy, and I didn't have any family in the Navy, but I just thought that would be the best route to go, and I guess it was. I don't know.
When we get into some of these stories, you're going to say, wow. So You went directly in, and they shipped you right over there to Korea then, is that right?
Yeah, we made one, they assigned me from basic training to the USS Essex, which was a jet carrier that had just been recommissioned and brought up to date and all the things. It was 3 football fields long, and we left Bremerton Naval Shipyard with 3,000 men, and we went down the coast and into San Diego, and we picked up a company of Marines and 125 airplanes, wow. And we sailed for Hawaii.
You know, you can't have any idea on the size, can you? 3 football fields and 125 planes. That's hard to imagine, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and we've seen some people, and we've never seen them again. You know what I mean? It was just like a big town.
Yeah.
Really, people don't really realize it, but it was. And my mother wrote me a note one time and wanted to know who my bunk mate was, and I said, I don't know. There's 105 of us in this one compartment. So it was
you
just
didn't know
like
the guy you were sleeping with. Is that what you're telling me, Ira?
Yeah. But they mixed everybody up. They, like you would have maybe 15 electricians, and then you'd have maybe 10 cooks. They never put all of the divisions in one compartment in case of a mine or a torpedo.
Sure.
You wouldn't kill all the people that were operating the ship and all that stuff. So they mixed us up in different places. But there's quite a crew of us, really.
So with that many men on the ship, I guess, and you had all different departments and stuff to work in? And
yeah. We had engineering, and we had Airedale Group, which was with the planes above, and we had machinists and boilermakers and electricians and cooks and everything. And we
How was the food on the ship? Do you remember? How was the food?
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, no, it could be great at times.
Uh-huh.
And other times, it was terrible.
What do you attribute it to?
Well, I think the cooks just got tired and fed up. And when we complained, they'd say, was you up at 4 this morning? And, of course, you know. But if we got a correspondent or a news person,
an
officer or an admiral came aboard, oh, the chicken was golden brown, and it was always good. But during the night, you could break it apart and blood would come out, you know. And we had cold storage World War II eggs that they cooked. And we'd break them open sometime, be chicken in them, and we'd just throw them in the trash can and get up and leave, you know. But the food, in general, you had something to eat. But sometimes we had the cold cuts for breakfast because if the sea got real bad, they couldn't cook. And we'd just eat what we could eat, you know. Because they couldn't put the pans on the stove, because if it did, it'd run right off, you know.
Sure.
So and the plates and stuff would run off the table. And, you know, it was, when the weather was bad, it was bad. And
now, you felt that ship, though. You were talking about how it rolls like, 10?
Oh, yeah, it rolls like 10, 15 feet. If you're way up on top, you can tell it real. But it had 5 floors down. I mean, 10 floors down and 11 floors up. So one time I had a general quarters station on the old 11 deck, and that was out in the open, right under the radar screens.
Wow.
And you're about 125 feet above the flat deck. And it rolled back and forth, and wind and rain and hail, and the Korean winters were
horrible, weren't they?
Awful. Yeah. Awful. They issued us heavy gear, but still you froze. You could stand still for 5 minutes and your clothes was froze.
I don't think they even anticipated how cold it was, did they? That's one of the things I've heard.
It was the coldest place I've ever been in my life, and I've been to Alaska, but the wind would blow, and if it was hailing and sleeting and that kind of stuff, The ship looked like a ghost ship because the icicles were hanging all over it, you know. And you
just don't think about that about Korea, do you? You
no.
think about it being kind of tropical
yeah,
or whatever.
But
yeah.
it's not. Oh, my gosh. They had roughly 30 minutes was the lifetime of a pilot if he ditched at sea. Because after 30 minutes, they didn't really
frozen.
Rush because
yeah.
he was already dead. You know, he froze to death. But,
wow. Now, have you been on cruises?
Yes.
Yes. I mean, I just wondered if you got off that ship and if you said, I never want to be on a ship again.
No, we went to Alaska and took that cruise. And since we retired, her and I have been to 13 different countries. We like to travel.
You like to travel? You like to take the ships?
Yeah, I like the ship. She gets a little sick, but it doesn't bother me because I stayed out 58 days one time and never seen land. So it doesn't bother me,
you,
but
yeah.
it bothers her.
Okay. All right, when we come back, we're going to find out how they met. This is an interesting story right here. We're going to go talk a little bit about September 16th, 1951. There was a big fire there. And you're going to hear some interesting stuff. So keep it right here on WCRS, 1450 AM. Don't you go away. We'll be right back.
Gold. Gold. More precious than any other time in history. Do you have gold? Do you need cash? Then bring it to SFG. That's Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood. Telephone 229-6613. Don't forget, we buy diamonds too. Paying the highest prices for your gold and diamonds at Sharp Facets Gallery.
All right, we're right back here, Sharp Facets Gallery. I'm Ann Eller. I am here with Carrie and Ira King. They are, where do you live now? Where do you live?
Spartanburg.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And what did you do when you got out and everything? What was your career path?
I went to school on Office for Machine Repairs in Indiana for 3 years and then came to Spartanburg and managed a place for a company and then... After that, I went in business for myself, and I had run my own business for about 27 years, I believe it was.
Well, that's great. Would you want to do a business today?
No, not
no.
now. Not now. I got out
Neither
at this
do
right
I, but
time.
I have to. Yeah.
No, there's been a lot of changes in the office machine deal,
yeah.
and Walmart and the other ate our lunch, you yeah. know, that stuff. But I sold out at just exactly the right time. And done great, but
that's good.
It was a lot of work. I had 14 employees, and it's hard to ride herd on 14 people, and you know.
It is, absolutely it is. People don't realize how tough it really
right.
is, yeah.
But the guy I sold out to, he told me, he said, why didn't you tell me that you had so much problem with the employees? And I said, well, that's just part of the game. You know what I mean? You have more trouble with them than you do customers.
Yeah,
you know?
That's true. That's true. Well, Carrie, how did y'all meet? How, because you didn't know him before he went to war.
No, I didn't know him. He came home with my brother one time when I was in Phoenix and I was in nursing school. And I dated him then, and we seemed to just hit it off. And then I was in Long Beach, California, when he was stationed there, and we dated then.
You had a hookup, is that what you're telling
That's
me?
It.
You hooked up, yes.
That's right.
That's right.
We just kind of hit it off.
So was he, did you dated when you were in Phoenix, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then was he still in the service and went away?
Mm-hmm.
And did you correspond, pin, you know, send
yes,
letters?
We yes, we did.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So there was, what did you think of her now, Ira? I need to know.
I thought she was kind of cute, so.
He was a good looking sailor, too.
He was. I tell you what, I got a picture here. I tell
yeah.
you what, isn't that, that's Ira, right? Yes.
Yeah, yeah. That's me just outside the Petty Officers Club. In Yokosuka, Japan. I just went over for supper and come out and took that picture.
It's a nice looking picture. Absolutely. Great picture. So you thought she was good looking, right? Kind of cute. Excuse
yeah,
me. Let me get
and,
it right. Kind
of
cute.
She was interesting. And of course, we was there just for a short while, picking up ammunition and different things. And then we left there and went on San Diego, and then from there on into Hawaii, and Hawaii to our main base was Yokosuka, Japan, because we had to, we couldn't go into a lot of harbors because we drawed so much water. I think it was like 40 feet. You had to have a lot of water to get a big ship like that in.
So when you met her, you know, after you dated her for a little while and here you are out at sea and everything, did you say, you know, I'm going to marry that gal?
Yeah. You think that. You got a lot of time to think, you know what I mean? But everything worked out pretty good, and we've been married for many, many years now.
How many years you been married, Carrie?
It'll be 60 December 3rd.
December 3rd.
Wow. What did you think when he went off to sea, and did he look kind of cute in his uniform here? What did you think about him?
I missed him, but I was busy going to school and working.
So, you know, if he came back, okay, but if he didn't, you know, you were moving on? Is that what you're telling me?
I prayed that he would come back.
Right. But, I mean.
Yeah. But I had no idea what he'd been through.
Yeah. It's an amazing, amazing story. You know, Ira, one of the things that I think, you know, they call it the Forgotten War.
Yeah.
Why do they call it the Forgotten War?
I don't know. I think it. A lot of people didn't really consider what was really going on, you know, because we had recently the Republic of Korea invited me back for the 60th anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
And they paid invited her away and wined and dined us for a week.
Wow.
And it was so nice to us, it was pitiful. And the last night that I was there, they gave me an award and gave me an Ambassador for Peace Award and a big ribbon around my neck and all that good stuff. And I felt like a mouse standing up in front of 200 people and receiving a award from the Republic of Korea. But I thought it was very, very nice. And they gave us a lot of, one jewelry company gave us all a watch, and another jewelry company gave us all 14 karat gold pin set.
They didn't give you a car, did they? They make cars over there today.
Yeah.
<laughs> Did they?
I don't know what they do with their old cars. I never seen a car over 5 years old.
For real.
And the 6-lane highways and the brick streets is nothing that I remember. I didn't see anything that I could remember.
I believe it.
I just couldn't. When we left there, it was rumbled. And now it's beautiful. High-rise buildings, apartments. And, you know, it's just clean as a pin. And on the hotel that we stayed, they had 20 flags flying out in front.
Wow.
16 that sent troops to fight,
mm-hmm.
and 4 that sent supplies.
Wow.
And all they did was bow and shake your hand.
Now, how many people were in your group?
125.
Wow.
They were from Denmark, United States, and the Philippines.
Any people that you knew?
I didn't know any of them, but I fought with them.
Right.
You know, they were all there together at the same time. But it was a wonderful trip, and the people are so nice, but they're so advanced electronically over us. It's
kind of scary.
You know, it's just amazing, you know, how it is. And their rooms are beautiful, and they have a full computer set up in there with different voltages and everything, and you can go in there and take your computer and do a whole day's work right in your room.
Wow.
And they got beautiful bathrooms, and I mean, it's just, you wouldn't
experience.
Believe it, you know. You just couldn't believe it. But,
you know, I interviewed I think it was the week before this ceremony, they had a group of Korean exchange students that were mm-hmm. here at Lander, and they had come to practice their English, basically, and get American culture.
Yeah.
And when I asked them about the Korean War, of course, these were 20-some year olds.
Yeah.
They had no idea.
That's right.
I had no idea. But I think it is so tremendous that the Koreans do this. You know, I've been to the Korean Monument twice. Mm-hmm. I've been Washington, D.C. And both times I was there, there were beautiful wreaths from the Korean people.
Yeah.
I think that is so tremendous that after all this time, I mean, we're talking 60 years, they're still sending flowers and have fresh, beautiful flowers there every time.
They're real thankful. I mean, they're really appreciated because it's just an entire different world they took us up to the 38th parallel, and I had been up there several times before, but the North Korean guards were skin and bones.
Mm-hmm.
They were just pitiful. And they had two of them standing 8 feet apart with a painted line, and this is the north, this is the south. And they had a one sitting back here on the side where they had a slide window.
Mm-hmm.
And we asked them what that was for, and they said they come to guard duty three at a time. If these two make any attempt to step across that line, he has to kill them. He's got a machine gun back there.
Oh, my gosh.
And they said...
So there's no escape.
No escape.
No escape.
And they said if he don't kill them, then when he goes back to his barracks, they kill him and his whole entire family. So, I mean, it's just fear. You know, they have no... I've read two books of guys that escaped from there, and it's horrible. I don't know why the United Nations lets it go on like that. But,
sure.
People have no say. This boy was that escaped. Him and his friend was going to go, and there was snow and stuff on the ground. They have an electric fence. If you try to cross it, it'll kill you. But he slid into it, and this guy, it killed him, and this guy crawled over top of him. Got some shock, but it didn't kill him. And he walked for 6 days to get to China.
Wow.
And China fed him, gave him some food, and helped him get a job. And the Chinese people were pretty good to him, you know.
Wow. Is that in the book you read?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Well, listen, we are here with Ira and Carrie King. We're talking about 60 years was the anniversary, July 27th. We're talking about that forgotten war that's not so forgotten, particularly to the Korean people, it's not forgotten. And for all the people that were there up there with Senator Tim Scott, it wasn't forgotten. And, you know, Ira, I haven't thanked you for your service to our country, but I want to thank you for your service to our country. And we're going to hear Join the News in Progress, and we'll be back. Don't you go away.
McDonald's presents Confessions of an Ex-Hipster.
I loved cappuccinos, so I put on an itchy turtleneck and grew a goatee. But before I knew it, I was into French films, indie rock, and not bathing. Luckily, I got help from McDonald's McCafe cappuccinos. Now I'm watching football, wearing khakis, even high-fiving again. Thank you, McDonald's.
New McCafe mochas, lattes, and cappuccinos from McDonald's. With fresh ground espresso and real steamed milk, it's all the coffee, hold the attitude. At participating McDonald's.
Visit your local McDonald's in Greenwood and Abbeville today.
We are right here. We are talking and just having such a good time. I'm here today with Carrie and Ira King. He is a Korean War veteran, and we were just talking about your trip when you went back to Korea. You actually went in May of 2012, right, Carrie?
Yes.
Now, Carrie, you were just telling us off the air, and people may have heard a little bit of it, about going to the monuments and whatnot and seeing the Korean children. Tell us the experience that you had when you were doing that.
Well, the children would come for a field trip, and they loved the veterans. They would hug them. They would kiss them. They had flowers. They would give them a flower. They had made things at school, and they would give it to us. They looked like little carnations. And they were just only too proud to talk to the veterans.
That's terrific.
They were what I liked the best.
That's what you liked the best? How'd you like the food in Korea?
I liked it.
You liked it?
Mm-hmm.
Did they have Korean food, or did they serve you American
every
food?
Every type of food you'd want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Everything. Mexican, Chinese, everything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You could just keep going around, and you could go from bologna to shrimp or lobster or whatever you wanted. I mean, the food, there's no shortage of food in the South.
Wow.
It's unbelievable how they eat.
That's terrific. You know, I was thinking what you were telling me about how they love the veterans and everything. I went on an honor flight with a group of World War II veterans, went up there to the World War II monument there in Washington, D.C., and there were lines of children just wanting to talk to the veterans up there. The giving out flags. You said one of the Korean children gave a flag to Ira.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that amazed the veterans the most was some of the teenagers up there in Washington, D.C., that walked over and would want to shake their hand and thank them for their service. That really does make you proud, doesn't it?
It does. And the little children would just wave those flags and holler, thank you, thank you, thank you.
So it really made you feel good.
They teach them to be proud, and they teach them that that's why they were living the life that they're living today.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing, I think, sometimes, Ira, don't you think that we forget that in America?
Oh, yeah. We just ignore a lot of things. We're so lucky that we can talk and say something. Over there, you open your mouth and they shoot you. You know what I mean?
If you step your toe over the line.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Or if you say anything about that guy in charge, that's a death penalty.
Sure.
And this boy that I'm reading the article about, he was 8 years old, and they took him out of the family, and they sent his mother to an underground slave labor camp, sent his dad to another underground labor camp, and his mother and her other son was talking to somebody about they'd like to escape and get away, and the word got back to the officials, and they made him go and witness them
killing his
machine
mother.
Gunning his brother.
Oh.
And they brought his mother in and they put a rope around her neck and hung her, and he was 8 years old, and they made him stand there and witness it.
You know, we talk about violence here in America, but I don't think we have any idea
no.
the graphicness that mm-hmm. happens in, well, I'll say third world countries.
That's
what
right.
what the difference is.
Yeah, it's they have no you know, they have nothing really. They go and tell the farmers that they want so many bushel of their grain, and if they only got 600 bushels of wheat,
mm-hmm.
and it takes 5 for them to live on, the government takes 5 and lets them live starve to death. They said there'd be hundreds of them will starve to death this winter if it's a bad winter,
sure.
because they don't have enough food to eat. You know, they don't.
That's in North Korea. Yeah,
yeah,
it's a very sad, very sad, sad state over there. But, you know, one of the things that I wanted to talk about with you that I found totally fascinating was when you were telling us about being on the ship on September 16th, 1951, and the plane and the fire that happened. Can you tell that story to us?
Yeah, it happened about 6:30 in the afternoon. And I was walking towards the bow of the ship because my fire station was on the hangar deck. That was the one down below. And then we seen all this, and the plane came in and jumped the barricades and just went charging into the 8 propeller-type planes that were already, they had napalm bombs, shrapnel bombs, everything on them. And that all started blowing up. And then it was just in a wall of fire for over 2 hours. And we got down below, and they let us out on the main deck. And we finally got our hoses and stuff going. And
yeah, but you said they let you out on the main deck. Didn't they push you out on the
yeah,
main
they
deck
put,
and
yeah,
seal
they,
the door?
They said, get out.
I think that's what happened.
Yeah, they said, get out there. You got about 2 minutes. And then they sealed the door behind us, and we knew that we was out there permanently. And it took over 2 hours before the fire was out, but they had washed it over on us, the fire, and we were walking around in ankle-deep fire with the water and the gas and the oil and everything that was burning. And we finally got our hoses up going, and we were able to push the fire away from us over off the right side, which was starboard. As they pushed it off over the top, we were the floor right under it, so we were going to have to push it. Because we knew if it encircled us, we was gone.
Right.
We wouldn't have had a chance. But we only had one big 4-inch hose, and you had to have 4 men to hold that hose with a nozzle, because if you open the pressure from a 4-inch hose, it'll throw you all over everywhere. So it took 4 of us to hold it, and we kept pushing like a windshield wiper, the fire back over the side, and the fire was running out into the water. It was out about half a block in the water, so no other ships could get that close to help us, because we was on our own as far as
Yeah, and you were telling me how the guys that were working on the planes, that were underneath the planes working on them on that deck,
yeah,
were just
they
burnt.
They were cremated immediately because we seen them at one time, we seen them working, and the next thing we seen was a wall of fire. And it stayed that way for quite a while.
Sure.
And we had to get the planes off, so they had to get the hoses going on top and push the fire out from under the planes. And then the guy had a big tractor with a big boom on the end of it, and he had to run up there and put that boom on the propellers and shove those planes until they broke the latches down where they were decked.
Now, is this something that you trained for? I mean, how did you know? Were you have training that if this happens, you do this?
Yeah, you have a certain amount of training, but it's never the same thing.
It's not like a real-life drill.
No, we had all kinds. I went through three fire schools, but still, we knew we was going to live through it. And this we didn't, wasn't sure about. But all the guys that were involved with the planes, putting fuel on them, filling the machine guns up inside, mm-hmm. and working on the bombs and stuff that were under, they were putting the primers and stuff in there. They were all cremated before they could ever get any water. They finally got water under the planes and pushed them off. Then the guy could come up with a tractor
and get them released.
He'd hit them on the propeller and shove them over backwards, and they'd go over the side into the ocean. But we were down underneath. We could see them hang. Every once in a while, a plane would hang, and you could see the fire going up between the bombs. It wasn't a good feeling, really.
It wasn't a good feeling. I guess not, Ira.
But as eight of us went out, and only one guy of our group got killed. But if it had encircled us, it would have burned us all up, because we knew that we couldn't let it get around us, you know, all the way around, because it was too hot, and I had some face burns and hand, but I wasn't burnt bad enough to scar, so I was lucky there.
Absolutely.
But we finally got it out about 9 o'clock, and I had a friend was a corpsman. And I went down to the electric shop and just laid down on one of the benches, and I told him to go tell so-and-so to come down here and bring all the equipment he needs, and I need you to take care of me. And he came down and brought his stuff, and he treated my burns down there. And then I just went and took my shoes off and fell in bed because I was so beat. We was all beat up pretty bad. But I had to muster all the electricians the next morning, and every company everybody had to be accounted for. And the last word that I got, you never get everything. Nobody comes out and tells you everything. But the last word I got was, we were 32 men missing and 9 planes, because they pushed over 8 of the propeller jobs that was on fire. And then they pushed the guy over that was in the jet, and he's still strapped in somewhere in the bottom of the ocean, because they just shoved him right on over, you know, and we never had no chance of ever getting him out, you know, because he was totally inflamed.
Now, were there any explosions?
Oh, yeah, it was about 3. I think the first one was when he hit the first plane, and that tank blew up, and then it was just chain reaction right on through, and until they all blew up.
Wow.
And then it was...
Now, what about the flagman? The flagman that was... You were telling me how the flagman jumps off and has a little bunkery to get in. What happened to the flagman?
He has a net to the side, and he tried...
net to the side? And it's not even a bunker? It's a net? Okay.
No, it's a big, heavy net, and it's kind of like a basket.
Yeah.
But if he stands there and waves the plane, he tells the plane to raise the wing. If a pilot is damaged, he's hurt, he's not going to listen to him. He's going to try to get that plane on that ship.
Right.
Because he knows if he goes in the water, he's probably not going to make it. But that guy, he crawls in and out of that basket all night long, you know, when they're
So what happened to him? Did he survive, or was he killed?
The guy jumped in the basket?
Yeah.
Oh, no, he lives.
He lived even through all of this?
Oh, yeah, yeah. He'd jump in that basket 8 or 10 times before 10 or 12 planes come in because, you know, they come in, they may not have no wheels.
Right.
They may have one wheel, and he wants them to ditch it.
Right.
Junk the plane. But they don't want to because they know they'll be in the water.
Right.
And if it's winter, that's murder. You know, I mean.
You told me, like, in the winter, what, 30 minutes in the water?
Yeah,
and they
30 minutes was about the limit. Mm-hmm. And if you fell in the water, it was. And, you know, the wind blew and the rain poured and the sleet and the snow. And
you wouldn't think of that in Korea. You just wouldn't think of that. You think
of
Korea as, you know, kind of warm and balmy, don't you?
Yep. In the summertime, it was so hot and so dusty and so bad. But then in the winter, I guess coming down from Siberia and up in there, it was so cold. A lot of guys froze to death.
Froze to death?
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. There's a lot of them. And I was reading this one book where this Chinese officer, they took him back and was touring and showing him places where their men fought.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, what's those guys doing standing out there in the field? The war's over. And this guy officer was showing him around. He said, they froze to death. They froze to death marching. And they were standing out there
wow.
in the snow up above their knees.
You know, that really makes more sense, though, when you see the Korean monument there in Washington, D.C., when you know that it was cold. And we've seen some pictures where the snow and everything at the monument there, and the guys, they look so gaunt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, if you happened to get a bunk where there was an open door or an open hatch that had to stay open, and you could lay in your bed and look out and watch it sleet and snow. I've slept many nights with all my clothes on, my shoes, and my two blankets, and take my body bag and zip it up, just let my head stick out and still freeze. It's just so cold.
Unbelievable.
Miserable time. I don't know how the people in the villages live. I don't know how they could stay warm in the little huts that they have, and they build a fire in the floor, down in a hole in the floor, and they heat the floor.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm cold-natured anyway, and I don't know how they ever took it, really.
You know, knowing this type of information, you know, they had Lieutenant Bill Funches that was there, that was the speaker.
Yeah.
And being they didn't call him a prisoner of war, he was a war criminal.
Yeah.
What he went through, when you think about the cold and everything, it is amazing that he survived.
He survived. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it's, they just, you know, and I read another article that, I do a lot of reading and I like history and this stuff. And this one guy, he had taken a trip to China and it was one of these tour deals.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to walk past this farmer's place. And he said the closer he got to this farmer's place, he seen this guy out splitting wood. And he said, gosh, he looked familiar. And said they walked up fairly close, and he said, he was my friend that I served with and went missing. And he said he recognized me, and I recognized him, but we couldn't say a thing.
Wow.
And he said they had give the Chinese him for slave labor, you know.
Wow.
And he'll work there the rest of his life, you know.
Now, when you think back over your whole experience with that, Ira, what type of memories do you have from all that?
Well, I have PTSD, and I'm on 60% disability. But I think I'm lucky. I know I'm lucky because I don't think that you're going to go until your time comes, because I had a lot of close shaves that there was always something going on. And you could walk into a propeller or, you know, anything could happen. I had a good friend that walked into an airplane propeller, and he was ducking on other planes, and he just happened to come up under one that was warming up,
mm-hmm.
and they shoveled him up. I mean, it cut him all to pieces. But you see a lot of things that happen, and you wonder why not, you know, how come it wasn't me?
Right.
But the, I guess the closest was is the, as they brought the fire, trying to push it off the front, they sometimes we get a crack in the flight deck where a plane had cut the wood and stuff, and they kept running the fire forward, and when it comes to that crack, it run down the wall, and we looked up, and
there was
the wall was burning, and the napalm was pouring down into this 50 caliber machine gun shells that the planes used. Well, some of those boxes started blowing up, and
you were right there.
We were right there. We couldn't go anywhere. We were just out in the open, and we had to stand there. And you'd hear them go off, and you just wondered, who's next, you know? Well, the guys standing shoulder to shoulder to me, one of them went off, and it must have hit him somewhere in the upper chest or something, because he just floated away and hit the wall and fell down on the deck. Never moved, never said a word or anything. And, of course, one of the other linemen had to come up and take my place, and I took his place. But he laid there, I guess, 15 minutes or so, and as soon as they got the napalm past that crack, then it stopped running down on us, and occasionally we could shoot a little water up there and stop it. But
you know, that's the thing about war and that type of thing. And, you know, I've heard stories like this for Vietnam where you just had to keep going.
Yeah.
I mean, you couldn't stop.
We couldn't stop and go over there because we knew he's dead. And you don't survive a 50 caliber machine gun bullet from a plane. And after a while, the fire got out of hand and it tried to get around us. And we had to switch from over there and bring the hose around here to shove that off on the other side. And when we did, pressure from a 4-inch hose just raised him up, and we floated him around, and he floated off underneath the rail and went over into the ocean. But he probably had such a big hole in him that he sank, you know. Uh-huh. Nobody picked him up.
Nobody
or anything.
Picked him up. Wow. Well, you know, these are the stories of war, and this is what happens. But you know, to be able to survive it, Carrie. I mean, you know, when you hear these stories, what do you think? I mean, you were in nursing school and being a nurse. Were you in the service or anything with Army nursing or anything?
No.
But what do you think when you hear some of these stories?
I think we have a wonderful, wonderful group of veterans. And they have done some beautiful work.
They have. They have. And they've created a country where we still have the opportunity to be free.
And you don't realize it till you see South Korea, what a great country it is, and how the people appreciate it. And the only thing bad about bringing the baby back was that was the good part, but think of the ones you leave behind.
That's right. And I want to get to that and talk about that because Ira was on the ship that brought back that baby, and we have, I think, enough time to be able to talk about this. Ira, this is the, Carrie, you can tell us a little bit about the movie part of this. This was the movie A Thousand Men and a Baby, right?
Yes.
And give us just the synopsis of the story, and then we'll go back and let Ira tell us some of the details, but tell us about it.
When the baby was put on the ship for the doctor to take care of him, he saved his life.
Well, he was part white, and that was the problem. They thought the baby was going to die.
Yeah. He was redheaded and blue-eyed.
Redheaded and blue-eyed.
And they knew he wasn't going to.
They knew he was half Korean and half American, and
Hospitals, I think, I mean, I don't mean to interrupt, but the hospital there, they would actually just throw them, literally almost throw them to the side, wouldn't
that
they?
That was the orphan's home.
Orphan's home.
And
yeah.
The Korean nurses wouldn't feed him. So that's why the chaplain wanted to bring him to the Point Cruz. And all of the men wanted to be his buddy. They watched him as he grew. They watched him as he turned over. They watched to see when he could set up. They bought him clothes.
And they used, sheets to make diapers?
Yeah,
is that what I read?
Sheets to make diapers, and then when they'd run the sheets up on the flag, thing, and the other ships would say, "We can't read what you got." Cause
it says baby on board. So how did you get to bring the baby back?
Well, the captain finally decided, well, we're going to take him back one way or another. And the chaplain said, well, I'll fly him back. I'll take him and fly him. And finally, the admiral gave up on us, and he said, just bring him home for Christmas. And we did.
But now you had to get the Vice President Nixon,
yeah,
right, was there.
He was there. He was over there for some kind of a special meeting. And the chaplain told him,
we got this stowaway baby with us.
Yeah, said, how do you like the captain's baby? And he said, what kind of baby? And he said, it's America. It's a personal, you know, it's not a monkey or something.
It's a real baby
it's
here,
a real
folks.
Baby. And he said, well, how'd you get it? And we told him, and he said, well, but the captain says, we can't get a visa. We can't get no cooperation from any of the officials. Mm-hmm. And he told one of the guys that was with him, he said, you go get that baby a visa and all the paperwork that he needs. And they went and got the visa for him to get his passport and all that stuff. They won it in a poker game.
I read that, yes.
They had to, he gave them the last Kentucky bottle of whiskey he had, and told him to go get in a poker game with some of the big officials in South Korea.
Right.
And win that baby's passport and stuff. So they played cards all night, and the sister, they drank, and she is kind of comical. She's a Catholic sister, and they asked her, she said, oh, no, I can't drink, and the doctor said, well, I understand it's good for just a little drink to help you. And she said, well, due to scientists, I'll take a little drink. And she took a drink of it. But they finally wound up winning the game, and they hocked their watches and everything else to get the money up. But they finally won it, and then they told them, we'll come by your office to pick up the paperwork. And that's how we got his paperwork, but the surgeon and the chaplain was beat. You know, they'd played cards like a day and a night trying to get it. But it was something, but we were lucky to get him. But if it hadn't been for Nixon, we probably would have never.
Well, you would have brought him back probably as a stowaway, and
yeah,
then it would have been a real problem, right,
yeah,
trying to get him into the country.
Get him into the country. Huh. But everything worked out, and he's a great guy.
That's right. He comes to your reunions and everything. You are listening to WCRS right here in Greenwood. We're going to carry this over just a couple of minutes here. Well, Ira, you know, I was reading the article. What did you have, a bomb carrier that you made into a carriage?
Yeah, we took crates that the bombs were put aboard on, and the guys took those and cut them down, cut the wood out of them, and made him a crib. That's the only wood we had.
Right.
So they made this crib out of a bomb crate, you know.
And then they had a carriage, though, that
yeah,
was used like a bomb carrier,
yeah,
or something.
Bomb carrier.
Yeah.
Yeah, it...
And what did it do for the morale on the ship?
Oh, everybody liked it. You know, everybody really felt close to him, really.
But, and he was adopted by one of the members.
Surgeons.
The surgeon,
yeah,
actually had adopted him. And I read in the story that they had had, what, three daughters, I think, or
yeah,
she had lost three sons.
Yeah.
So they adopted.
They adopted him. And one of his sisters and his mother put on a reunion down in Florida one year for us.
Mm-hmm.
And we all went down there.
So you got to see him.
Yeah. But he's quite an interesting person, and he's just one of the lucky million, because the streets are full of them that were half-breeds or left behind or homeless or parents was killed. And they had a bad habit of coming into the villages and killing the adults and let the kids just freeze to death or starve, you know. That was one of their...
Their
ways
of
night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Ira, I tell you what, this has been such a wonderful experience for you to share. And, you know, I think it brings the war, the Korean War, more to the front because we've talked to somebody that we know that was there in Korea. And I really appreciate you taking time being here. And again, I want to thank you for your service to our country.
Thank you.
And Carrie, thanks for bringing him here too, and y'all sharing your story. This was fun, wasn't it?
It was, and we enjoyed being here.
Well, thank you so much. This is WCRS right here in Greenwood. We have been talking to Carrie and Ira King. Ira is of course a Korean War veteran, and his wife, they're from Spartanburg. Thanks so much for being here today. Bye-bye, everybody. That'll do it for us.